Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
A certain number of people go to concert halls for the great music of orchestral compositions, and others listen to that music by records in their home. But millions go to the movies, to cinema, who never go to a concert hall. And I know in talking to them, sometimes I meet them in trains or on boats or in the street or somewhere. They have a kind of feeling of that it's too formal to go to a concert hall, and they would feel uncomfortable. And they're even afraid of great music. And if they hear it by cinema, they realize this is very interesting, this music.
It's a question of getting over the music of the masters to a wider public than would otherwise
exactly be. That, yes, you said it better than I could have said it, but that's how it is.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. We're exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. Before we jump into this week's episode, we have another message to share this week, this one from listener Robert Berg.
Hi, I'm Robert Berg, and I just wanted to say how much I've been enjoying Ink and Paint. I'm a lifelong Disney fan and am even a former Disney Store cast member. And I actually ran a blog a while back where I watched all of the animated Disney films over the space of a year myself. And I did a lot of research for the project, and even with that, I'm learning new things on every episode of the podcast and getting whole new levels of appreciation for these films that I thought I knew inside and out. And I also happen to have a master's in dramaturgy, so this podcast just hits my Venn diagram of interest perfectly. The conversations with theater makers and filmmakers are so illuminating, and it's really opening up the films for me on whole new levels. So thanks so much, and I'm really looking forward to continuing to rewatch all the films along with Daniel.
Thank you so much for this lovely message, Robert. One of the real joys for me doing this project has been making new discoveries and enhancing my appreciation for these films, so I'm glad you've been able to have the same experience listening along. If our other listeners would also like to send in an audio message with their thoughts on the podcast, listen in at the end of the episode for details. In our previous episode, we looked at the second Disney animated feature, Pinocchio, an enormous artistic success and unexpected financial failure on its release. This week, we have the first of our two-part look at perhaps the most ambitious film in the Disney canon, the groundbreaking and controversial concert feature, Fantasia. Each episode on Ink and Paint, I am joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, I'm joined by composer, conductor, musical director, and theatre maker, Ashley Clapp. As a composer, Ashley has worked predominantly in theatre, choral works, and in languages other than English, and her practice has taken her all over Australia and the world, working with many diverse cultures, languages, and musical traditions. Ash, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Ah, thanks for having me.
So, for our listeners, tell us a bit about your practice as a composer and a conductor, because you have a very exciting and fascinating practice as an artist.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, being a composer and conductor in 2020 is it's a difficult time. So, therefore, I've had to kind of like adapt with my art. And go into like filmmaking and things like that as well. However, I was trained as a classical composer. I loved orchestral music and I still love orchestral music. Love the textures and layers that you can create with an orchestra. And that's kind of how I got into writing for theatre, is because I loved writing for orchestras and like no one would play for me. So I pitched my work to like theatre companies like when I was at uni and things like that. And that kind of, you know, slingshotted my career as a theatre composer. And again, being a conductor came kind of by accident, because I had a musical director and conductor on for my first symphonic musical that I composed, and they dropped out. They said the music was too difficult for musical theatre, and I was like, well, it's not musical theatre, it's a symphonic musical.
I mean, that sounds a bit like a compliment, really. Your music is too difficult.
I had too many time signature changes, and I was like, oh my goodness, this person's a hack to begin with. So I kind of had to jump on the podium and was conducting everything wrong, and I had to learn a lot. But, you know, that's part of the job. You learn while you're on the job, I guess. Yeah, but I wish I could get more into orchestral music and conducting orchestras. It's just the climate isn't really here at the moment.
And another thing that you work a lot with cultures all around the world, different musical traditions, but also in the talks we've had about your practice before, you've always talked about the experiences of working in communities and with people who have little to no music training or even exposure to music. What is that process like, having to work out what is possible from the groups that you're working with, but also what the traditions of music are with the groups that you're working with?
Yeah, oh, amazing. I mean, because I've grown up in Perth, Australia, which is its own culture in itself, very sheltered was my upbringing, I guess, in that kind of music culture. So therefore, like living in Kenya, I was living in a little village just out of Mombasa. The music traditions are so rich, and like these kids that I was working with, I was predominantly working in this orphaned school. It was like a school for orphaned and single parent children. Oh my goodness, there was like 9 different languages. They could all sing in harmony. Like, it was unbelievable. And all I had to do was kind of tease out what was inside them, which for me it's the easy part because they've already got all the talent there. So yeah, that is my favorite thing to do, is just pull apart little bit by little bit little musical gems from people and then create something amazing with it.
It's kind of like, it feels like the democratizing of music. I mean, because music is often, for so many people, either it's the thing they have in the background, or the idea of composition or orchestral or choral music seems like a kind of interesting, well, obviously we'll probably talk about a lot talking about this particular film, but like an almost a kind of an elitist, unattainable thing. Like a lot, the way you've always spoken about this kind of area of practice always sounds like it's about, you know, making music a democratic exercise for people. It's not unattainable.
Yeah. Even like working with uni students, some of them don't even realize how easy it is to like write music. I think some people just think it's, yeah, for elitist or like, you know, talented virtuoso, Mozart or something. But if I just pull it apart little bit by little bit, like let's just get like a bass line down, done. Like that's all we're doing. And just layering on top and sequencing, they realize, oh my gosh, like I'm creating orchestral music right now. Even with kids, I write orchestral music with like 9-year-olds who don't even realize they can do it. And then I just, you know, I'm just chucking it on top of each other. And then sometimes it gets a bit like, you know, Bach would have a bloody nightmare thinking of the counterpoint that's been created. Like, let's just simplify one of the lines. I really love that process. That's definitely my favorite thing about music and creating music.
Well, to segue into talking about your practice into Disney, the first question that I ask in relation to the Disney animated classics for each of our guests is, what was the very first Disney animated classic you remember seeing?
Good question.
See, I could be nice and kind of prep people for this, but I love that reaction of just, oh, what was it?
I know that we had on VHS the little video of the Silly Symphonies.
No way, really?
Oh, and my sister and I loved it. And like the little water babies, we just like, we watched those little films so much until like the film like snapped. Yeah, we loved them. But like a full feature, I've got a feeling it wasn't super, like you'd think it'd be one of the real old ones, but I've got a feeling it was like the Little Mermaid. Like that's like early 90s, right?
89,
I think it was Little Mermaid, because I would have only been like one when that was out, and so therefore when I was probably like 3, it was probably like Frozen kind of hysteria for The Little Mermaid, for a little girl who was three. So I've got a feeling, I still remember near the end of The Little Mermaid where there's this, it's like the scene and like I think she's getting married and there's like a boat and the animation of the glistening of the water, like, oh, I remember it being absolute magic, being like, that's not real life. Like, it was just so special. And there's like choral music singing and like she's kissing and I was like, oh my God.
I think it might have been, I it's funny asking this question. I'm not entirely sure what the first one was I saw, but I know that the first one I saw at the cinemas was The Little Mermaid. And I remember it having, yeah, a pretty, it's quite an overwhelming film for a child because it has, particularly because of like the musical complexity and the character complexity and how beautiful it looks. So yeah, it's very easy to imagine that having an enormous impact, particularly for, you know, a little girl 3 years old. It's kind of fabulous. What was then your relationship with Disney growing up and into adulthood? Have you had much of a relationship with the Disney animated films?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I remember when Pocahontas came out and the orchestral score for that was like next level. And I was a French horn player, actually. That was my little high school instrument. And the horn lines in Pocahontas, like hauntingly beautiful. I didn't even know the instrument existed before Pocahontas. Yeah, and I think even for some of my orchestral, like, theatre scores, I remember one of them was highly influenced by Disney. Actually, a few of them have been very highly, like, those flute themes that are very much in so many Disney scores have featured in my music a little bit.
Because, you know, we were very lucky in that when we were kids, it was the, you know, the Disney Renaissance, and we're getting to see films like Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King and Pocahontas and Aladdin and Hunchback, these films where music has kind of taken a step forward again after years of kind of sitting in the background. Like, it's so influential. And also, to kind of segue into talking about the film we're going to talk about, this film became available when we were kids for the first time in a very long time. The potency of music in Disney films was such a big deal for us. I mean, I feel the same way. I keep looking at the work that I make and I see strains of Disney films through all of them, and the music particularly, like, you know, the Alan Menken scores, and like, they're just the absolute best. I know they're like 30 films away in this project for me, but I'm kind of like, oh, I can't wait to get to the Disney Renaissance, mostly just to talk about how great the music is.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, we've got a big task ahead of us. We're taking on this enormous film.
It is enormous.
Yes. So we should probably get started. Mickey Mouse needed a reboot, and Walt Disney had an intriguing idea. Rather than coming up with another slapstick scenario, they would marry the international icon with the high art of classical music. It would involve the most famous conductor in the world and utilize technology that had hardly been invented yet. The short would go wildly over budget and could never make that back at the box office. An idea had been planted, though, between the studio head and the conductor to take this idea of a marriage of music and animation and expand it into something else, something new, something wildly ambitious. The result would be one of the most acclaimed, most controversial, most groundbreaking animated films ever made. One that would transform not just animation, but cinema itself. It was a film unlike any other. In fact, it's hard to know whether to call it a film at all. Comprising 8 sequences, none of which narratively connect, some without narratives or characters at all, it may be better described as a visual concert, a collision between the art of animation and the traditions of classical music. If such a film was attempted now, it would be seen as ambitious at the very least. That it was not only attempted in the late 30s, but was also the third animated feature film ever made, is almost insane. In 1938, Disney ran into world-famous conductor Leopold Stokowski in a restaurant, and being a fan of the conductor, introduced himself. He told Stokowski about a new Mickey Mouse short in development, set to composer Paul Dukas's The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and asked if he would be interested in conducting the music. During the making of the short, Disney and Stokowski began discussing a much bigger idea, a concert feature, where each classical piece was accompanied by an animated response. This concept had been the basis for the Silly Symphony series, albeit with popular style music, But this would be the ultimate culmination of that, an intersection between popular and high art. Story directors Dick Humer and Joe Grant were tasked with composing a preliminary list of potential pieces, ones that might lend themselves to animation. Hundreds of compositions were considered, with Disney, Stokowski, and musical commentator Deems Taylor debating and considering all of Humer and Grant's suggestions. They covered the full history of classical music, from the most popular and romantic to the most modern and radical. The great music of all times, as Disney put it. On September 29, 1938, around 60 of the Disney artists came together for a two-hour piano concert, where Disney spoke about the pieces and their possible use, and showed a rough version of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. His enthusiasm for the project was palpable, providing a distraction from the troubles on Pinocchio. The next morning, 9 pieces were chosen for the film, though one would eventually change and another be removed altogether. The film would take over 3 years to complete, involving over 1,000 artists and technicians, realizing over 500 characters. Stokowski oversaw the arranging, conducting, and recording of the music, culminating in a 7-week recording in April 1939 with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Philadelphia Academy of Music that utilized groundbreaking recording technology. In every respect, and with every single department, the resources of Walt Disney Productions were put to the ultimate artistic and technical test, all while also completing the mammoth production on Pinocchio and trying to crack the riddle of Bambi. For most of its production, it was simply known as the concert feature. Only much later and after a studio-wide survey did they come up with the perfect title, a musical term referring to music with a free form and often improvisational style, Fantasia. So, Ash, when was the first time you saw Fantasia?
I remember when Fantasia 2000 was coming out and, like, the shots of the big blue whale, like, falling with, it was just beautiful. That was kind of when I even heard about Fantasia, and I didn't even know there were two Fantasias.
So that's quite late, because Fantasia 2000 was January 2000, so that was quite late to discover that the film existed.
Yeah, like, I guess I had Beauty and the Beast and things like that to worry about.
They had stories and characters. This was just a bunch of music.
But I didn't grow up with classical music at all. Like, my dad was a farmer. My mum didn't, you know, finish high school. My love for classical music and even knowing about it came a lot later in life. So I didn't really know anything about Fantasia until the Fantasia 2000 came out. And, like, for years after that, even, I didn't know that there was an original one before that.
Right. When did you first see it then?
I remember seeing, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice clip, like, definitely from a young age. But I had never seen Fantasia in full until literally, like, this week.
Oh, really? Oh, that's amazing.
Well, I recognize most of the clips. So I've seen them all in times of my life, but only as, like, short little bits. I'd never seen it all at once in a two-hour kind of epic. Yeah, but I remember, so, like, from when you said, oh, we're going to talk about Fantasia, I was like, oh, I definitely remember, obviously, Sorcerer's Apprentice, Rite of Spring. I love Stravinsky, and that is one of my favourite pieces. So I do remember the dinosaur bit, because that was quite, it's like revolutionary, like the evolution of animal and et cetera. So I knew about that and how that was a really big deal. But, like, I don't think I'd ever seen any of the Pastoral Symphony stuff. I've seen, yeah, Dance of the Hours, like, little clippets probably within, like, you know, you're watching something on, like, Cheese TV or something. They're like, check this out from 1940. And you're like, oh, that's cute. But, yeah, like, I hadn't seen a lot of it, which is crazy.
That actually makes me more excited about this chat. I've been watching Fantasia since I was about 4.
The 1941?
Yeah, this film of Fantasia I've been watching consistently. My parents bought me the VHS when it came out, and it was only released for like 4 months. It was a very, very limited release VHS. And for some reason, my parents bought it for me. And I was absolutely obsessed with it.
Wow.
I remember very distinctly being given it, and I just watched that video until the cover fell apart, until the tape. I think my mum still probably has the VHS somewhere. And so it's a film that, like, you know, in prep for this, I watched it 4 times in a row, and every single time I was just like, oh, I love this. Like, it's, and I think it was partly the reason, because I was really big into classical music as a kid. as a really little kid. And I actually think a lot of that has to do with this film, because it was my first exposure to, like, same, Rite of Spring is probably my favorite piece of classical music, and I only know
it
because, yeah, oh, we're going to have great, we'll have great fun when we get to when we get to the Stravinsky. It's exciting to talk to someone for whom this hasn't been a massive influence, because I think there's a certain extent to which Fantasia is a foundational text, particularly for people who love music and for people who love animation. I'm excited to talk to someone for whom it isn't, because it means we've got a set of fresh eyes, which is what, you know, this podcast is all about.
Obviously, I know a lot of the music. Like, I studied a lot of this at uni in my undergrad. But to see it, like Night on Bald Mountain, I love Mussorgsky. And I think for a motivic kind of, you know, orchestral piece, it is just stunning. And when I started watching it, I was like, oh my gosh, like the animators would have had a field day with motivic music. Like I was watching it like so excited. I couldn't, because I don't know, to be honest, there's like parts of it where I'm like, I'm bored, this is too long.
Well, that was going to be my next question. What did you think of it?
It was boring in lots of parts. But when I got to Mussorgsky, I was like, oh, this is perfect music to be animated to, because it's constantly shifting. Yeah, so like there's parts of it I was like, I can't believe I've never seen this. This is absolute masterpiece.
The film begins with no title or credits, but with curtains opening, revealing an almost Art Deco stage. We see the shadows of orchestra members entering, taking their seats, tuning their instruments. Once everyone is settled, Deems Taylor, dressed in a tuxedo, steps into place and begins, as he puts it, this Fantasia program.
Now, there are three kinds of music on this Fantasia program. First, there's the kind that tells a definite story. Then there's the kind that, while it has no specific plot, does paint a series of more or less definite pictures. Then there's a third kind, music that exists simply for its own sake.
Joseph Deems Taylor was a renowned music critic and composer, familiar to Americans through his intermission commentary for the New York Philharmonic. It was thought that Taylor's presence would help guide the audience through the film and provide similar context to what would be offered at a live concert. There were concerns that his commentary could come across as stuffy or off-putting, so moments of levity and humour with the players were orchestrated, many of whom on screen were played not by the Philadelphia Orchestra, but by members of the Disney staff. The Taylor introductions, realised with dramatic shadows and striking blocks of colour, were shot in three-strip Technicolor by cinematographer James Wong Howe, who would go on to shoot Yankee Doodle Dandy, Sweet Smell of Success, and win Oscars for The Rose Tattoo and Hud.
Well, I thought the Moulin Rouge has a little bit of a parody where it kind of opens
That's
in a similar
true,
way.
Yes.
And then they conduct the, you know, the credits of, what is it, Universal or Paramount?
Fox, 20th Century Fox.
Fox, yeah. It's interesting that a lot of Fantasia has been parodied, and I've seen the parody before the original, so it's quite funny. I don't know. It's very old-fashioned, isn't it? Like, here we are. We're going to talk now because this is a film.
At the time, there was lots of questions about whether or not that worked. And, I mean, we'll talk later on about what happened with the release of the film. But, I mean, that the Taylor introductions to all of the pieces were the first thing that was cut from the film. Do you think they serve a necessary function in the film?
Well, I think if this is an educational film for, like, high school students, right, where they are learning about this music and, you know, like the history of it, etc., it seems like it should be there. But if it's just a feature film for, like, you know, random audiences in cinema, you know, cinemas, it's a bit weird. It feels very like, I'm about to tell you what you're about to see. It's like, why can't you just let me listen to it myself? But obviously the Disney team, including Deems and Stokowski, like, love this stuff and they want the audience to know it. So it's nice that they want to share that passion and love, but every time he's talking, like, oh, why are you still talking?
Yeah.
You're not even the conductor. Like, get off the stage.
And he does, often I realized rewatching it for this, he really tells you everything that's going to happen before it happens, which is very similar, like, for example, you know, if you go to see a Melbourne Symphony Orchestra performance, there's often that person that stands up in the foyer beforehand and gives you a full rundown of the history of the music and what the music has inside it. It very much functions, it's the film very much trying to function like it's a concert, like it's an actual orchestral concert, which, I mean, kind of brings the question, which is a question I think we'll come to again at some point, but of who the film is actually for, which I think is a great push and pull in Fantasia of, obviously, it's a significant cinematic work, but who is, like, if an audience is walking in for off the street in 1940 during the Second World War, they're walking in to go for a few hours entertainment and they get met with this. First of all, it's, you know, how are they going to respond to that? But also, if it's there to appease music lovers, does it do that function as well, or is it just, does it just seem a little hammy and obvious?
No, it's babying it down. So I reckon they missed the mark there because they're passionate about it, so they want to share this, but who are they sharing it with? It feels like it's for high school students, you know, like, because they've babied it down a lot, but therefore, and they want the like the elite music lovers to like this, but they're babying it down for them, so why would they like that? So I feel like they were stuck in this middle ground, and they should have, I think, just cut all the commentary.
Well, I mean, they did. Eventually, that's exactly what happened. The best thing, one thing I do love about those sequences, though, is that they just look so incredible.
All the lighting and the shadows. Oh, yeah.
Because it's also, this is the first time we've seen any, like, that there's been such a thing as a live-action Disney sequence. Like, up until this point, there's only been, like, there's been flashes of live action in the very early Alice comedies in the 20s. But other than that, we've never seen real life, like, shot as if it was a feature film, a traditional live action feature film. And so it is the kind of thing of, it's the world of the orchestra as defined by the principles of Disney animation. So the colors are so striking, the shadows are so striking. It's not reality, it's kind of like it's a dreamscape version of an orchestra.
Now, the number that opens our Fantasia program, Toccata and Fugue, is music of this third kind, what we call absolute music. Even the title has no meaning beyond a description of the form of the music. What you will see on the screen is a picture of the various abstract images that might pass through your mind if you sat in a concert hall listening to this music.
As Taylor finishes his introduction to the first piece, maestro and conductor Leopold Stokowski steps up to the podium. One of the preeminent conductors of his day, Stokowski was known for his theatrical flair, both in his conducting and his habit of modifying the orchestrations of the works he conducted, and in how he presented himself. At the time of Fantasia, he was the director of the Philadelphia Orchestra and well known to music-loving audiences.
So now we present the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, interpreted in pictures by Walt Disney and his associates, and in music by the Philadelphia Orchestra and its conductor, Leopold Stokowski.
Captured entirely in silhouette, Stokowski raises his hands, no baton, a signature move of his, and with a blast of strings, the concert begins. Toccata and Fugue in D minor was composed for the organ by Johann Sebastian Bach at some point in the early 1700s, though no exact date is known. It was a signature piece for Stokowski, who had recorded an orchestral arrangement in 1927. As Taylor says in his introduction, this piece fits into the category of music without any narrative associations or structure. Walt Disney had become interested in abstract filmmaking after seeing Len Lai's experimental animated short, A Color Box, in 1935, where images were painted directly onto the film itself. Rather than balking at the lack of commerciality, Disney was fascinated by modern art, and over his career would reach out to many prominent artists to collaborate on projects at Walt Disney Productions. One such figure was German abstract animator and filmmaker Oskar Fischinger. Working as a special effects animator and experimental animator in Germany, both before and in the early days of the Nazi regime, Fischinger had been creating short works using charcoal on paper that combined his love of music and graphic art. In 1935, thanks to the success of his work Composition in Blue, he was invited to the US by Paramount Pictures. Fischinger joined Walt Disney Productions in 1938 as a motion picture effects cartoon animator and began work developing the Toccata and Fugue sequence for Fantasia. He had actually considered the project himself in 1936, even approaching Stokowski for the rights to his arrangements, but the project never developed further. Disney wanted the sequence to feel as if the audience were half asleep in the auditorium, with the images of the musicians and the music merging in their imaginations. He also wanted the sequence to reflect the improvisational style of Bach's work and process. Many of the images in the Toccata and Fugue reference visual moments later in Fantasia, such as the boulders in the Rite of Spring or the cloud formations in the Pastoral Symphony, acting very much as an overture to the concert. Disney had even considered filming the sequence in the then highly experimental format of 3D. Almost instantly, he and Fischinger began to diverge in their ideas. Fischinger pushed for greater abstraction, less literal imagery. For example, the image of his violin bows had been reduced in his concept art down to simple lines in space. He also wanted several ideas to be occurring simultaneously. Disney was worried, though, that the greater abstraction and simultaneous action would be too much for the audience, and with Stokowski's support, dialed back on the extremities of Fischinger's ideas. The animator eventually left the studio, feeling that the sequence didn't reflect his work.
Knowing that it was going to be the Bach Toccata and Fugue to open up Fantasia, I'd never seen this before Tuesday. and I was like, what? Like, it's absolute music. It's not programmatic. And I thought all of Fantasia was going to be programmatic, as in like a composer sets their piece to a story or like feelings and gestures or how you want someone to feel in different movements.
So not dissimilar to the Silly Symphonies, for example.
I guess so, yeah. But, I mean, with Silly Symphonies, you'd know this better than I. Were they composed just for the animations, or
most of them were. They would take classical music motifs and adapt them. So the Skeleton Dance I know was riffing on, I think, a Berlioz piece. But not all the music was written specifically for those shorts. Even if they were referencing pre-existing music.
Yeah. However, like Berlioz was one of the most famous programmatic composers, and he used to set out, like, he'd pretty much write stories, and then you could read the story and then listen to the movement and absolutely get it all captured in your brain. Whereas I feel like even in all these episodes in Fantasia, they would really take the story that the composer has in mind and then kind of change it to what they want to do with their animation. But hearing that Bach was going to be first up, I was like, he's king of absolute music. It's, you know, a fugue is kind of like overlapping repetitions of a theme that was basically improvised in the Toccata to begin with. So I was like, what is going to happen here? And I did watch Len Lay's A Colour Box just to see like what did inspire him. Oh my God, what the hell was that? It was insane to think that was the inspiration of the day. Is like Fantasia is a huge step up. It's insane to think that was the level before Fantasia.
And it also flies very much in the face of what you expect from Walt Disney Animation, because we're so used to the very set particular style that the idea that Walt Disney's watching works like Len Lai's work or Oscar Fischinger's work, seeing like impressionistic or expressionistic modern art and going, that's what I want to, I want to create works in those veins, is quite a surprise. I mean, it makes this whole sequence make significantly more sense because, you know, yeah, I mean, what was the experience of watching it for this being the first like act of this film?
I guess knowing that Fantasia is like animation, et cetera, when it starts off for so long of the piece and it's just the orchestra and the shadows and the light, I was really intrigued because I was like, I was not expecting this at all. And I guess because, you know, you're not following a story, you do get really lost in the shapes on the screen. So the way I kind of approached this task is I had a little notebook in front of me and wrote down little things that I liked as I watched them. So there's things in my notes that say like, lit up timpani, that's cool. And there's like shadows of string players in different lights, almost 1970s rock star-esque.
I love this, please. I can't wait to hear all of these.
Oh, so funny. But I think it really elevated the classical music. Plus, like, I had heard the orchestral version of this, you know, it's a keyboard piece, you know. So hearing it being orchestral, I had heard it before, but I think if it was just for keyboard, it would not have been as successful as it was with all the modern art imagery.
Yes, it can't. It's so rousing. There's something that, like, every time I hear, like, you hear those opening notes of the Toccata and Fugue in that context of, like, a full orchestra, and it's like every, I remember even as a kid, like, every hair on your body just stands on end, like, it's electric. And if you're wanting to start, in a way, it makes sense. In a similar way, I mean, this is many films, in many films' time, but the same way that Fantasia 2000 starts with the opening of Beethoven's Fifth, like, it establishes instantaneously the grand scale and ambition of what this project is. That first of all, we're going to take on a piece of music that has no story, that has no pre-existing images, from arguably the greatest composer who ever lived, and we're going to find a way to animate that. And we're going to approach it with modern art sensibilities. I mean, you know, that you can definitely see that there's, again, another the push and pull between Disney and Fischinger of, you know, wanting full abstraction towards something that makes a certain degree of at least visual or emotional sense. But I mean, it is, like, it's still one of the most striking, befuddling and wonderfully confusing sequences in the whole film.
Yeah, for sure. I really loved the different mediums of art. Like, I was, because I had seen Sorcerer's Apprentice when I was a kid, and it's, I feel like Sorcerer's Apprentice, that really Mickey-style animation is what I was expecting.
Yeah, the nice clean lines and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that real classic Disney look. And so when this, when the animation part did start, the kind of modern art animation, there was like, sometimes it looked like chalk pastel clouds and things like that. It was very like French impressionism at parts. And then there'll be like line drawings in other parts. It was just like, I wrote down on my page, like, I wish I was on drugs right now.
The resurgence and popularity of the film in the 60s and 70s was a lot to do with people, you know, getting high and going to see Fantasia. Yeah, exactly. That there was the lack of sense, like, because there's no thematic or logical sense to the Toccata and Fugue sequence in the same way that there's no, you know, logical sense to the piece of music itself. I mean, the thing I love in the research that he did was the description of Disney saying he wanted it to be like the audience was in a concert hall falling asleep, which is a really strange thing to say for what you want your audience's experience to be at the beginning of your film, but that's exactly what it's like. And I actually find myself every time I go and see an orchestra, I always find myself disappointed that it's not like the opening of Fantasia, that it's, you know, because, I mean, particularly when you go and see things like Beethoven's Ninth or, you know, The Rite of Spring or these big, giant, magnificent pieces of music, you want the whole room to be responding to it. Like, every molecule of the wood in the room should be humming because of this music. And instead, like, I remember going to see, I think it was Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, and a few seats away from me was an older couple. And as soon as the music started, they pulled out their Sudoku books.
What?
And I was like, oh, this is a radio for you. Like, the music is just, it's just a background thing. And really what, I mean, the really great thing about, for better or worse, with this sequence is that it makes it clear the music is the most important thing in this film. And we're not treating it like it's sacred. We're not treating it like it's forgettable. We want you to be paying attention to it. And in a way, the beautiful thing about the abstractions in the Toccata and Fugue is that it's making you pay so much attention to what you're hearing, possibly more so than any other sequence in the film.
I think so, definitely, yeah.
You know, it's funny how wrong an artist can be about his own work. Now, the one composition of Tchaikovsky's that he really detested was his Nutcracker Suite, which is probably the most popular thing he ever wrote. Incidentally, you won't see any Nutcracker on the screen. There's nothing left of him but the title.
Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker Suite was first performed in March 1892, incorporating 8 movements from the full ballet composed by Tchaikovsky, which premiered later that year. The ballet was based on Alexandre Dumas' adaptation of E.T.A. Hoffmann's The Nutcracker and the Mouse King, and while the ballet was not initially a success, the concert suite became wildly popular all over the world, much to the annoyance of Tchaikovsky, who considered it a lesser work. Rather than using Hoffmann's original story of a young girl on thrilling adventures with her magical nutcracker doll come to life, Disney and his team conceived the sequence as a dance of the seasons. Stokowski's arrangement of the suite only used 6 of the 8 movements and changed their order to fit the dramatic action of the animation. The seasons instead served as a backdrop, the sequence becoming a ballet of nature, including dancing mushrooms, ice fairies, and spinning blossoms. It would become one of the most popular sequences in Fantasia and further propel Tchaikovsky's music towards cultural popularity. I mean, it's probably a silly question, but how familiar were you with the Nutcracker Suite before you saw this version of it?
Oh, very familiar. Yeah, for sure. But I did not realise that when Fantasia was dropped, when it premiered, that the original Nutcracker ballet had never been performed in the US. So it wasn't really well known for the US audiences.
No, and there's that great little moment in the commentary where Deems Taylor kind of talks about it like it's forgotten, like it's kind of a vaguely forgotten work, and you're kind of like, wait, what? And
they're like, no, it's not.
And a lot of, like, I mean, in the case with a lot of these pieces of music, their endurance in popular culture is down entirely to their inclusion in Fantasia.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how my first experience with this piece of music was most definitely through this. And what did you make of the interpretation?
Oh my gosh, it is so beautiful. I think it's one of the most kind of clever animationed to classical music pairings. I think it was so stunning. And I know they only used 6 of the 8 movements, but my goodness, so beautiful. Little racist, but very beautiful.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of Fantasia is known for its racism. But the thing that, you know, gets by with the Nutcracker Suite is you can kind of almost pretend it's not there. It's definitely harder in other parts, but you can definitely try and pretend it's not there. But I mean, like, you know, the dancing mushrooms, which is such a problematic stereotype, but is also absolutely the most gorgeous sequence. Like, it's so beautiful.
But then you look a little up close and you see, like, little slants drawn as eyes. You're like, oh, why? You should have just left no eyes. And
but how do you think that it works, that it benefits from having rejected the story, from like leaving the story Clara and the Nutcracker behind and just focusing on this?
Well, I guess because the music is so like evocative, it's so, and it has so many beautiful moments where it's really stripped back, which I think out of a lot of the pieces that are chosen for Fantasia, this one, Tchaikovsky, really, really enhances those really intimate moments. So like the Celeste, at the beginning of Sugar Plum Fairy, having the little go from like pretty much pitch black to lighting up flowers is so delicate and perfect. It's such a perfect dramaturgical response to the Celeste line. So I think they had not free rein, but well, probably free rein of like, we can shape this however we want. And I think it's a better story to like show the seasons changing through these little fairies and little blossoms and things. I think it's really, really sweet.
And it's much simpler. Like, it's because the story of the Nutcracker and the Mouse King is like a surprisingly complicated story. And this, the fact that it's just focusing on the natural movement of the seasons, and it's almost like you could go, if you could ask nature to respond to the Nutcracker Suite, this is what it would do. Like the flowers doing the Russian dance, and like the blossoms going down the river, and the fish, and all, like, nothing about it seems every response to every section makes complete sense, like emotional sense, where you go, no, that's exactly what that music would look like
as well. There are moments where, because of the response in animation, you hear so many more lines of music that. So when we're talking about the little toadstools, I had never noticed the kind of plodding bassoon line ever in that segment. I always like was focused on like the upper strings because they have the melody, but because of the little toadstools plodding, you focus on that section of like that layer of music.
Yep. And the fact that that layer is the layer that's actually being visualized, really. Like,
exactly.
That beat is what, you know, gives them the mushrooms life, but also kind of defines the mushrooms' existence. Like, that's why they're in the sequence.
Yeah. Whereas I never focused on that ever before. Like, it was just like, I don't know how I even could get it out of my head. Like, it's amazing that you can just, it's not even to do with like the volume of what that line is. It's just, it is the focus because they are, yeah, their rhythm is to the bassoon line. It was so clever.
And I guess that's something that, you know, their knowledge of, I mean, what each of these sequences, whether or not, you know, subjectively, whether or not you think that their interpretation works or not, the one thing you can't deny with any of these sequences, and I think this is a good example of it, is that the animators and the team conceptualizing these sequences know this music back to front. Like, the fact that they can take something as simple as the bassoon line in that particular movement and go, let's accentuate that every single action in the sequence is in response to something with the music. And that's not just in terms of the way things move within the frame, but also the color and the design, like, you know, the Arabian dance.
Sexy fish.
Like, the way that they move is, and the way they're even drawn is defined entirely by the quality of the music.
Yeah.
They're paying such attention to that. I mean, there's a certain degree to which Stokowski is orchestrating this music to make it work specifically for these sequences. I mean, we'll talk about that with The Rite of Spring probably more so than any of them. But there is a sense of going that the animation is working with the music as opposed to working against or in opposition to the music.
Yeah, I wonder how they did it because, like, using Arabian Dance, the fourth movement, with Sexy Fish, because you hear those portamento strings, you know, those like glissy strings that go like parallel, and those little trills. And you, if you closed your eyes and had to think to yourself, like, all right, what are we going to do with this visually? It sounds like you're underwater. Like, you can just feel like bubbles around you, and the way it washes and ebbs and flows is like a perfect expression for it. So I do wonder, like, what came first? Like, oh, let's enhance this a bit more because we want it underwater, or I reckon it has to be they hear it and they go, this has to be underwater, listen to this music.
Which kind of makes, I mean, obviously all of these sequences and the responses are entirely subjective, and I mean, that was one of the big arguments against the film when it was released, but I think that's the reason why so much of the film is so successful and why this sequence in particular is so successful, is because it is such a specific response. Like, it's not just them kind of going, oh, let's just do anything. It's no, this is where the sequences in Fantasia come from the emotional imagination of the people creating them, as opposed to just trying to be clever. And that makes the sequence to be one of the most popular sequences in the film. Like, I think it's still if you ask people to name sequences from Fantasia, this is one of the first ones most people would name.
Yeah, this is one of my favourites for sure.
And that's for you who's only just saw it a few days ago and it's already one of your favourites.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. And the thistle dancing in, what movement's that? Fifth movement, Russian dance, the thistles dancing. A little bit, now hear me out, foreshadowing Beauty and the Beast Be Our Guest?
Totally. Oh, 100%. Yes! 100%. 100%. And the thing that's so, that sequence is almost one of the most visually exciting because it changes its animated form. Like, there's those moments where it's building up and it's towards its climax, and it starts like cutting and shifting between different forms of animation, and just like it's like there's kind of a rhapsodic joy to it. I mean, that's a thing that I would say about the sequence, is it's so joyous. And the way that it, like, even the building towards the snowflake fairies at the end, that it kind of has to kind of, the whole thing, the way it's structured and the way it's visual storytelling just kind of builds to this beautiful climax.
Yeah, the waltz of the flowers going from the autumn to the winter. I know Tchaikovsky just from being a classical music nerd, the tempo change when it goes into the frozen section, Stokowski really amplifies that, because I don't think I've heard it be, you know, so dramatic before. But with the animation where it goes into frozen, you're like, oh, like your heart stops, like, oh, icicles, beautiful. It's very, very clever.
And now we're going to hear a piece of music that tells a very definite story. It's a very old story, one that goes back almost 2,000 years. a legend about a sorcerer who had an apprentice. He was a bright young lad, very anxious to learn the business. As a matter of fact, he was a little bit too bright, because he started practicing some of the boss's best magic tricks before learning how to control them.
The sequence that launched the Fantasia project originally began as an animated short of its own and was born out of necessity. Mickey Mouse was now over a decade old, and the animators and story team were starting to find his temperament and scenarios limiting, often falling back on the same gags or situations. He was also in need of a redesign, having barely changed since his initial designs by UB Iwerks. Animation techniques had become more advanced, but Mickey Mouse hadn't evolved with them, and along with the enormous success of Donald Duck, the character was experiencing a decline in popularity. French composer Paul Dukas' symphonic poem, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, was written in 1897, based on Goethe's poem from 1797. The piece had already been the basis for a short film by William Cameron Menzies in 1930 and had been used in Oscar Fischinger's short Study No. 8 in 1931. Walt Disney acquired the rights to the music in July 1937, and Stokowski signed on to conduct in December that same year. The task of redesigning Mickey fell to Fred Moore, who refined the basic design and gave Mickey a wider range of expressions by putting pupils in his eyes. Walt wanted the short to go beyond the slapstick bawdiness of the Silly Symphonies and canvassed the staff at the studio with a questionnaire for ideas on how the structure of the action could work. More than any segment in Fantasia, The Sorcerer's Apprentice preserves the pre-existing story of Dukas' music and Goethe's poem. Live-action reference was shot for the entire sequence, including a UCLA athlete jumping barrels to help with Mickey's moving through the water. For The Sorcerer, the animation staff reportedly used Disney himself as a reference, giving the character the nickname Yen Sid, Disney spelt backwards. Unlike the rest of Fantasia, this sequence did not feature the Philadelphia Orchestra. Recorded before the concept of the full feature was broached in January 1938, Stokowski handpicked 100 players for the orchestra and recorded the piece at a stage in Culver City between 12 p.m. and 3 a.m. His reasoning was that the players would be so hyped up on coffee that their freneticism would translate into the performance. Stokowski also pushed for the music to be recorded stereophonically, an uncommon practice that the conductor had become a champion of. Each section of the orchestra was recorded on a separate track to later be mixed together. The Sorcerer's Apprentice soon became hugely expensive, three times more than the average Mickey short, and Roy Disney became concerned that the short would never recoup its budget at the box office. Disney saw this as an opportunity, though, and in February 1938, the first discussions around what would eventually become Fantasia began to take place. How familiar were you with this piece of music outside of Fantasia or this particular section?
Ooh, I don't know, because I feel like everyone knows this, you know, this little clip of Mickey and the broom and the water. It's all like mashed into my like my knowledge of this piece and this piece of animation. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I even was like, I had to check. I was like, was this the only piece that was written for the show, like the Fantasia? And I was like, oh no, it's kind of old. I should have known that.
I think that's kind of the point with it, is that it is very hard. I mean, you know, if you're overly familiar with Fantasia, it does kind of become hard to separate any of these pieces of music from the animation, but this one probably more than any because of the enormous impact it Mickey's presence within this story has. I mean, this sequence is absolutely fucking incredible. Like, it's just one of the most incredible. Like, if this was a 10-minute short on its own, it would be like, it would still be legendary. It's just such a perfect piece of storytelling. It's a perfect marriage of music and style of animation, perfect match of character and narrative. It's one of those sequences that just does every single thing right.
Yeah, and I think the program, like, because this is very specific for that poem, because it's very specific programmatic music, and they use it almost exactly. I think that really helps in the fact that the program is so clear to begin with that they can just, like, we've got our story. We don't even need to, brainstorm different ideas.
And also the fact that it comes very specifically in Fantasia from, you know, a piece that is entirely abstract to a piece that has no narrative but has something within the natural world for the audience to hold on to. And then it settles into this three-act structure, relatable character, very relatable because it's a figure that the audience knows, that it's by this point, if you've kind of started to kind of ease into Fantasia, this is where you really settle into it. And into understanding, like, you've also been presented by basically the three types of languages this film has: abstract, non-narrative, and completely narrative. So it's a great, in a way, it kind of completes the nice primer for how to read Fantasia. How much of this version of Mickey like defines your understanding of who Mickey Mouse is as a character?
Yeah, I think all of it. Like, I can't really remember too many of the little Mickey, you know, the really old-fashioned Mickey shorts.
Like Steamboat Willie.
Yeah, like little bits, like my memory can remember the style of what it looks like and kind of his voice. And then this Sorcerer's Apprentice is like my whole knowledge of Mickey and all his expressions and his cheekiness.
I mean, they're kind of some of them are these are the defining images of what we have as Mickey. Like in the moment of Mickey imagining himself on the cliff controlling the elements is maybe the most famous and enduring image of Mickey Mouse that we have. It's also amazing that it's a Mickey Mouse that doesn't talk. Like, we're so used to the kind of squeaky quality of Mickey's voice, and so like all we have is just this beautiful character animation and it's kind of a great consolidation of everything that that character had been and everything that character could be.
Even with the sorcerer hat, like I think I forgot that the reason why he wears that blue hat in so many pictures is because of Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's not his hat, it's the sorcerer's. I just completely forgot about that. It's just so much a part of his identity.
There's a wonderful quality in the second half of this short once he starts to realize that the brooms are very much active. He has no control over it, where there's such a tremendous sense of danger and drama to this. I mean, it's aided by the music. And, you know, I was also wanted to ask about Stokowski's method of recording it at, you know, midnight high on coffee.
That's so random, isn't it?
But you can hear it in the music, like particularly once after, you know, he's chopped up the first broom.
It is so, oh my gosh, that murder scene, oh my goodness, it is so dramatic. And it all goes into red and black and white, oh my gosh, it's so Scorsese.
And then there's that thing that I just love, that after he's killed the broom, it goes to black and white. Like the whole color palette. And then as the new brooms are kind of being born, the color fades in and out, and then in and out along with the music, and like, you know, the marching quality and how it gets bigger and bigger and bigger the more there are, like, oh, it's such a great perfect little piece of drama. This 10 minutes. Yeah.
There's so much of the pairing of Vision to music, just the use of shadows. You know, in the beginning, it's I don't know how they conceived it. Like, you just see that, how the sorcerer fades out in his shadow, and then Mickey's shades up, and you're like, and the music just elevates it all. And the growing of the arms with the Coron Glay, and like, oh my goodness. The animation, though, of the slopping water. I'd never seen anything like that.
I think the lucky thing for this particular film was that they were making it at the same time as Pinocchio, and because the whole last section of Pinocchio with Monster of the Whale is set both on and under the water, it meant that the development of water effects were very prevalent at the time. And I know they were experimenting with ripple glass to try and give the for that moment where that amazing shot where the brooms are marching down into the water and then like nothing, like their rhythm and pacing isn't changing, and you can see the distortion of them as they go under the water. So that was water effects were very much a focus at the time.
And I think that kind of water animation in the Ave Maria, which we'll talk about later, the reflection, oh my goodness, I have no idea how they did that in the time.
There's also this is the sequence where you can really see a strong influence in other cinema. Like, this is such a German expressionist influenced piece. Like, you can see Caligari and Nosferatu written all over this. The like the angle of shadows, the like a character entering with their shadow first, the drama of the angles, the drama of the cut. Like, even though obviously those films are in black and white, you had such a sense of color and texture in them, and that's so prevalent in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. While the other pieces in this film seem to be finding their own language, this is the one sequence where you can definitely sense that they're playing with cinematic, live action cinematic language, which I think just makes it all the more thrilling and weirdly haunting, and incredibly arresting.
That haunting nature is definitely throughout the whole thing. That I think the theme, like, is like, because it's so, you know, it just rolls and rolls and rolls. You can, like, the marching just makes it so creepy.
It's kind of like, it's almost like it's a more frenetic, crazy version of the bolero. Like, it's this, the rhythm is going to keep going and eventually it's going to collapse. But with the bolero, it builds to this like triumph. And with The Sorcerer's Apprentice, it has to collapse, which I guess is, you know, when the sorcerer returns and, you know, casts the water aside, that is the only logical way this theme could be, this musical motif could be resolved. It has to collapse. Like, there's nowhere else for it to go. It will just continue to build and build and build forever. In the same way that the brooms will never stop filling. Like, the water will never stop, the brooms will never stop. The other really lovely little thing I wanted to kind of mention with this sequence, though, is the moment at the end where Mickey shakes Stokowski's hand, which is just so gorgeous. And it was only when I was re-watching it again for research in this that I actually realized that the voice of Mickey up until that point was Disney. So Mickey Mouse was always voiced by Walt Disney himself. And so that little there's something kind of nice about that little moment where it's, you know, Mickey goes up to Stokowski and goes, my congratulations, sir. You know, congratulations to you too, Mickey, is kind of Disney and Stokowski congratulating each other on, hey, we fucking did it. Look.
Oh, that's sweet.
We're a third of the way through. If they haven't left yet, they're not going to leave now.
When Igor Stravinsky wrote his ballet, The Rite of Spring, his purpose was, in his own words, to express primitive life. And so Walt Disney and his fellow artists have taken him at his word. Instead of presenting the ballet in its original form as a simple series of tribal dances, they have visualized it as a pageant, as the story of the growth of life on Earth. It's a coldly accurate reproduction of what science thinks went on during the first few billion years of this planet's existence. So now imagine yourselves out in space, billions and billions of years ago, looking down on this lonely, tormented little planet, spinning through an empty sea of nothingness.
When composer Igor Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, with choreography by Vaslav Nijinsky, had its first performance in Paris on May 29, 1913, legend has it that the evening ended in a riot, the audience deeply shocked by the avant-garde nature of the music and the primitive evocations in the choreography. The Rite became a sensation, both in ballet form and concert form, and is now seen as a significant moment in 20th century music. In the early stages of development on Fantasia, Disney had suggested a sequence on dinosaurs and prehistoric life, and Humer and Grant suggested Stravinsky's earlier ballet, The Firebird. Inquiries were made into the rites, but Deems Taylor put forward The Rite of Spring as a better option. Upon hearing it, Disney was ecstatic, and at $6,000, the rights to the music were secured. The sequence depicts the emergence of life through to the death of the dinosaurs. And though earlier plans proposed continuing through to the age of mammals and the first men, these were abandoned so as not to upset creationists who did not subscribe to Darwin and Wallace's theories of evolution. Until that point, dinosaurs had mostly been depicted in animation as comical, such as Winsor McCay's beloved 1914 short, Gertie the Dinosaur. The animators and story team turned to experts at the American Museum of Natural History for a better understanding of current research and discoveries into prehistoric life, to ensure their work was as accurate as possible, lending the sequence weight and drama. Concessions were made, though. For the fight between the Stegosaurus and Tyrannosaurus Rex, animated by future animation legend Wolfgang Reitherman, a Triceratops was originally considered, but they went with a Stegosaurus instead because of its spiked tail, even though the prey and predator had not existed at the same time. The sequence was also a benchmark in special effects, overseen by Chinese-American animator Cyrus Cy Young. Thanks to the notebook kept by technician Herman Schulthess, many of the secrets behind the effects in the sequence have been preserved. Stravinsky is the only composer to have been alive at the time of their music being used in either of the Fantasia films. He visited the studio in 1939 and attended an early sweatbox session on the sequence. He was supportive during the making of the film, but later objected to the changes Stokowski had made to the music and was mostly dismissive of the sequence itself. His ballet The Firebird would later be used as the finale for Fantasia 2000. The Rite of Spring sequence would later be distributed to schools in the US on 16mm film for use as a teaching tool on prehistoric life. So Ash, what is your relationship with Stravinsky's ballet The Rite of Spring?
I love The Rite of Spring. I think it sits better as a concert piece than a ballet because, well, if you've seen any footage of the original, it is weird as hell. It's so strange. But my favourite part of Rite of Spring is the dance chorale, and it was not in this, and I'm so devastated. Oh, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that was the thing. Stravinsky just absolutely hated Stokowski's arrangement of the music. And it was quite a shock because as a kid, I only knew the Rite of Spring through Fantasia, and it was only when I was in my teens or early 20s that I discovered, like, I finally listened to the ballet on its own. And it was quite a shock to hear that the ballet is, in a way, structurally nothing like what you have in Fantasia. One thing I will say about Stokowski's arrangements, though, and maybe this has a lot to do with the stereophonic recording, is that the experience of listening to The Rite of Spring in this film is not that far removed from the experience of seeing The Rite of Spring live. Like, it still maintains the tremendous drama of this music. And even in the way that, like, it may bring out particular instruments more so than others and the changes it makes, it still has that kind of visceral... Like, I remember seeing The Rite of Spring performed live for the 100th anniversary, and it was like you were kind of being hit by a wall of music. It was like in every single sinew and bone in your body. And it's not dissimilar watching it in this sequence. Just the sound of the music is quite incredible.
Yeah, all those accents are incredible. Those, like, cello accents are just, like... But I want more of it. Like, we hear those kind of cello, like, and double bass, you know, the dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk-dunk in the dumpster adolescence with the volcanoes exploding. And I'm like, yes, here we go. This is the Rite of Spring I love. And then obviously it's really featured in the dance sacral. And we don't really get it again. Like, I don't know. I guess, like, the parts I love of this piece weren't really showcased as much as I'd like them to. So I was a little, like, sad about that.
I think this is probably more so than any... Maybe this and the pastoral are probably the two sequences where you can see the music is more being morphed to match the animation as opposed to it being there's certainly a degree to response, like the volcanic eruptions. Actually, I would probably say anything that involves the earth in this sequence is definitely that you can see and hear the animators responding to the music itself. But the sequences with the dinosaurs, that's where they're starting to kind of manipulate the music to kind of fit whatever narrative or world they're trying to create. So what did you make of the visual representation of this sequence, like deciding to go, instead of it being a series of primitive dances, which is what it was in Nijinsky's choreography, to make it about the creation of life itself?
Well, to put it this way, its original, themes are three dudes wanting to sacrifice a young girl. I'm not a big fan of that in the first place.
No, this is probably a bit of an improvement.
And I, growing up, obsessed in dinosaurs, like, I used to love, there's a few books in our encyclopedia, you know, in book form that we had at home that I used to constantly look up. The dinosaurs were one of them that, like, if you looked in that book, those pages were super shabby because I was constantly reading and looking at all the pictures of dinosaurs and dinosaur bones. And I loved whales as well.
Oh, whales are the best. There you go. There's both the Fantasia films. Done.
Exactly. So knowing that Rite of Spring is dinosaurs and it's so earthy and really, like, oh, it's so visceral, you know. I was very excited, and I already knew that this was a thing. I'd seen little bits of it, but never in one kind of. I had never seen it all together, if that makes sense. And being like, obviously, the rituals, this Russian folklore, is supposed to be like to express primitive life. So therefore, it does make sense that it would be like an evolution of life.
Certainly a lot more than it would if it was the Firebird. Like, I was quite surprised when I found out in the research that originally it was they were going to use the Firebird for dinosaurs. And I was like, no, the Rite of Spring makes much more sense.
That double bass opening, though, is like, oh, I can imagine that as a perfect opening because it starts like pianissimo and builds and builds. That would be a sick opening. However, the greatest bassoon line ever written to be like, now life is forming. That is perfect. Like, come on.
To see the formation of the solar system to that bassoon line.
Oh.
And I mean, they were on top of trying to be as accurate as possible with the representation of the dinosaurs, like they even had like astronomers come in to look at the work they were doing for that sequence to try and work out whether how accurate.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, like I said in the introduction, dinosaurs were only seen as comic characters, mostly because of Gertie. And Gertie had a massive impact on the world of animation and on audiences in America when it was first released. And it's a really gorgeous, really cute little animation. But they were only seen as things that could be funny. So The Rite of Spring is the first time of going, no, what if we look at them as animals? And really, the next time anybody would look at dinosaurs that same way would be Jurassic Park in 1993. I was trying to think of, like, are there any other examples where films have gone, no, let's treat the dinosaurs like animals? Because really that's, they were either used as monsters, like, you know, they're used in, like, Journey to the Center of the Earth. They're used, like, you know, they'll get, like, you know, standard lizards and, you know, put paint all over them and make them look like dinosaurs. They're only seen as kind of, like, monstrous threats. In this sequence, its power is that they go, no, these are real living, breathing things. And even though they're only animation, in some cases, is quite rough animation because they're drawing things they don't have any visual reference for, they still have a tremendous amount of weight to them and drama and power. And this is probably like, this is based off very recent research that they had. Like, dinosaurs were not a popular thing at that point. A lot of our understanding of the popularity of dinosaurs in popular culture probably has a lot to do with this sequence, particularly because kids were watching it in school to learn about prehistoric life.
That's so cool. Like, can you imagine being like a high school student learning this and you're like, okay, I'm going to learn about evolution. That's cool. And you get freaking Stravinsky. You're like, lucky me.
And it's, you know, that it's, again, it's the power of the animation, even for all of the problems with Stokowski's arrangement, the power of the music and the concept of dinosaurs battling is so visceral and so powerful that it leaves an enormous impact. The music has an enormous impact on you as a kid when you watch this, and you don't forget this music. Like, for most people, this is the point of entry and reference into not just The Rite of Spring, but Stravinsky's music, full stop.
Let's talk a little bit about Stokowski's edits.
Yes, sure. Well, you're more authoritative on this particular subject than I do. What are some of the big things? What are some of the big edits that he makes, and which ones are for better or worse?
Well, I think. So one of the big kind of the classical music nerds that did watch this in the time were like, how dare they cut so much of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring because it needs to be as is, right? And like, it was a big issue for a lot of the critics, right? And I think in a 1940s kind of mindset, it's like, this has to be exact because it's art and it's perfect. And now we're in 2020. A lot of stuff is chopped up for us that I felt there were moments that should have been edited more. I know, controversial, very
really?
Controversial. Yeah. And I think because my favorite section was cut, like, come on. And it's the actual finale where the girl is sacrificed, where she dances. That is the main cut of this Fantasia Rite of Spring. And I think that is the most rousing piece of music, that little section, that episode.
It's astounding. Like, it's just, as a finale to any piece of musical composition, it's kind of unparalleled.
And yet they finish on the glorification They finish on the dance de terror, which is actually the finale of part of the first part of Rite of Spring, not the second part. So they kind of like did a bit of a choppy changey thing, and it is nowhere near as dramatic as what the finale should be. But there were sections of it where I was like, oh, I forget how there's like real boring bits of this. I was like, even the Stegosaurus are yawning right now. Come on, let's move it along, people.
I do have to admit, though, I do love the way, for the context of the story they're telling in this sequence, I do love the way that they return to the opening bassoon line motif at the very end, as like the Earth has kind of reset itself after the death of the dinosaurs, that it kind of returns to this, you know, that zoom out shot of the Earth. And, you know, also it's worth remembering that this is 1940. We don't know what the Earth looks like.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no one's seen it. And so it's, like, again, having to conceive, you know, what does the Earth, and particularly what does a prehistoric Earth look like? But, yeah, I mean, it is, you know, if the more that you know about the music itself, I mean, that's kind of also the nice, really is a nice thing, is that if this becomes a gateway, if Fantasia becomes a gateway to discovering a piece of music, probably more so than any other piece of music in the entire film, there's such a joy when you listen to the Rite of Spring in its entirety and hear it in its entirety and discover all of those extra new moments and beats and the incredible ending.
But we don't get the incredible ending in this version, though, which is such a shame.
We get dinosaurs fighting.
Yes. Yeah. But I think, so when the horn call happens and the T-Rex is there, you're like after such a huge amount of boringness, sorry, Stravinsky, I love you, you're just like, oh my God, finally, we're going to get some freaking dinosaur action. Because before that, they're like, here's a pterodactyl, little clarinet flourish. And you're like, yeah, do it twice, not seven times.
It's a bit of a nature documentary in prehistoric Earth. Yeah, it's kind of what it's attempting to do.
Very true. But I felt like we could have got to the T-Rex a little earlier. But then again, like, I was getting really tired at this stage, forgetting that it's a two-hour film. They were going to place it at the end, and instead they put it at the end of the first half because they didn't want everyone to be like, oh, my God, the dinosaurs just died. And I actually think it's a really creepy relevance to right now to climate change.
Oh, please, talk about this.
Watching it, I was like, oh, I was just like, oh, my God, like all the dinosaurs are dried up in the desert and they're dying. I was like, is that what's happening right now to us as humans? Oh, my gosh. History repeats itself.
you're so used to seeing the death of the dinosaurs be the collision of like a meteor or a comet into the Earth, and you don't see that. You just see them like waste away. It is like it. I think I had a similar thought watching it, going, "Oh, it feels a lot more prescient than you would expect." And it is a bit of a, and like the high drama of this sequence is like, you know, is kind of like, and also the high drama of the music as well, it could have been quite exhausting as an audience. I mean, like you were saying, halfway through this 2-hour film, you kind of feel like you're a little bit drained by this point, which is why there is an intermission in Fantasia, just like there would be with a concert. And, you know, Disney originally had planned to put this at the end because he thought it's, you know, too dramatic and too devastating and the audience will need a chance to recover, but it would have been a pretty downbeat ending to the whole program. So instead,
everyone's dead.
it works much better as
an act one finale.
Yeah, in the way that a good act one should always end on like a high note of energy that then leaves you to consider and to ponder when you walk out into the foyer. So in that sense, it's the perfect place to leave Fantasia in its first act for the audience to have its original roadshow presentation, for the audience to have a moment to leave the auditorium, go outside, have a drink, have some fresh air, and consider the enormity of what they've already seen. Not just the enormity of that sequence, but the enormity of the whole first act of Fantasia. Because, I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, you've now been presented with all the different ways these animators are going to respond to this music. You've heard music performed in a way that you never have before in a film context, and seen music responded to in a way you never have in a film context, that in a way it's nice to have that. It's nice to have that moment of reflection to go, what the fuck have I just been watching?
Plus, Stravinsky is probably the most modern piece that they have.
It was definitely the most modern piece. Yeah.
So that would, I think, if audiences, I don't actually know, had audiences heard much of Rite of Spring before Fantasia?
It's the 40s, so yeah, and it was pretty, like, the riot from the first performance had got a lot of attention. So, yeah, it definitely would have been.
Yeah, I think, I guess the non-classical music audience would be like, oh, my God, what is this, like, postmodern, like, clusters of tones that aren't, like, you know, standard melodies, and the time signature changes, I think, would have been quite a shock. I think putting it to this kind of rough animated, like, volcanoes, and it would have actually made it the piece a lot more palpable, or palatable, I should say.
Well, both, actually, both palatable and palpable.
Yeah,
because
true.
you have like the earthquakes and rock and lava crashing against one another. That's what it feels like to listen to this music. And not in the sense of, like, when you listen to the music, you literally visualize that, but the idea that what Stravinsky wrote was elemental and tectonic. I imagine that's what freaked people out about the music when it was first performed, was that he was talking about something so primal that it's deep, deep, deep within your gut. It's deep within your bones, and he's making voice to something ancient and historic and, in this particular case, prehistoric. Like you were saying before, this is a piece of music written about primal dances. So the great primal dance of the earth is its creation and the dinosaurs.
I think as well that riot that is so famous is there's a lot of debate about how much of a riot it was, because people wanted, I think it was like a publicity stunt, like a riot was happening on opening night, and then some of the concert goers were like, no, there was no riot, like, we really enjoyed it. So it's one of those debates of, like, how much of a riot was there. But the conductor did say he got things thrown at him, so.
My favourite story is that Nijinsky had to stand at the side of the stage and yell out the timing for the dancers because they couldn't hear. And look, it may not be true, but it's a damn good story.
I think more than anything, it was actually the choreography that the audience is really put off by, because they go into a ballet and there's, like, knock-kneed, like, really obscure kind of movements, like modern movements that no one had ever seen before. It would have been an incredible experience, actually.
Which actually probably is not dissimilar to a way of describing the response a lot of people probably had to this film, of going, this is an experience of, like, an experience that I would not expect having in a cinema, and it's also not an experience I would expect having in a concert, this radical reinterpretation of what these forms mean. So in that sense, the Rite of Spring being included in Fantasia makes a tremendous amount of sense, because it's, you know, in terms of 20th century music at the time, it was, you know, the game changer in terms of the way people perceived what music could be. Fantasia, to a certain extent, does that with classical music, with film and cinema and the experience of an audience. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
The fact that in the premiere there was like 80 speakers around the audience is insane.
Ash and I continue our chat about Fantasia, looking at the controversial second act, the groundbreaking sound technology invented for the film, its failure on release, and eventual redemption. Thanks to Ash for joining me on this episode. You can find out more about Ash and her work on Vimeo at vimeo.com/AshleyClapp or on Instagram at AshClapp. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the making of the first act of Fantasia, including concept art, animation sketches, and links to some of the early experimental shorts mentioned in the episode. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Ink and Paint. Hit us up with your comments, questions, or even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We release new episodes every fortnight, so if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform, and don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Original music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Pirinakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics. it begins and ends in a completely different manner. The structure. Oh no. Oh, my cat has decided it wants to wake up and say hello to me. Hello,
aww,
Dexter.
Hi, kitty.
Oh, you're gonna star in every single one of these, aren't you?